reeking so fiercely that she must have been hurting her throat. She looked so fragile, so pitifully vulnerable. Laura was briefly overwhelmed with loathing for Dylan. She almost sagged, almost went limp, almost crumpled under the weight of her anger. Earl holstered his gun. He reached out to Melanie, but she struck his hands and scrambled away from him along the baseboard. "Melanie, honey, stop. It's all right," Laura said. The girl didn't heed her mother. She reached the next corner, sat down, drew her legs up, fisted her small hands, and held them up defensively. She was no longer screaming, but she made a strange, rhythmic, panicky sound. Crouching in front of her, Earl said, "It's okay, kid. It's okay now, it really is. It's okay, Melanie. I'll take care of you. The door," Melanie said. "The door. Don't let it open." "It's shut," Laura said, hurrying to her, kneeling by her. "The door is shut and locked, honey. Keep it shut. Don't you remember, baby, there's a big, new, heavy lock on the door," Laura said. "Don't you remember?" Earl glanced at Laura, obviously puzzled. "The door is shut," Laura continued. "Locked, sealed, nailed shut. Nobody can open it, honey. Nobody." Fat tears welled in the child's eyes, spilled down her cheeks. "I'll take care of you," Earl said soothingly. "Baby, you're safe here. No one can hurt you." Melanie sighed, and the fear ebbed out of her face. "You're safe. Perfectly safe now." The girl put one pale hand to her head and began to twist a strand of hair in that absent-minded way that any ordinary girl might twist her hair when preoccupied with thoughts of boys or horses or pajama parties or any of the other things that preoccupied kids her age. Indeed, after the bizarre behavior that she had displayed thus far, after alternating between extremes of hysteria and motionless catatonia, it was both moving and encouraging to see her playing with her hair, because that was such a normal act, a small thing, simple, hardly a breakthrough, not a crack in her hard, artistic shield, but normal. Seizing the moment, Laura said, "Would you like to go to a beauty shop with me, baby, hmm? You've never been to a real beauty shop. We'll go and get our hair done together. How would you like that?" Although her eyes remained somewhat glassy, Melanie's brow furrowed, and she seemed to be considering the proposition. "Lord knows you need something done with your hair," Laura said, anxiously trying to preserve the moment, expand upon it, deepen and broaden this unexpected contact with the girl inside the artistic shell. "We'll get it cut and styled, maybe curled. How would you like your hair curled, honey? Oh, you'd look just great with lots of curls." The girl's face softened, and a smile threatened to take possession of her mouth. "And after the beauty shop, we could go shopping for clothes. How about that, honey? Lots of new dresses and sweaters. Even one of the glitzy new jackets the kids are wearing. You'd like that, I bet." Melanie's unfinished smile stopped forming. Although Laura kept talking, the mood was gone as suddenly as it had come. The girl's placid expression gave way to a look of disgust, as if she had seen something in her private world that horrified and repulsed her. Then she did a startling and disturbing thing. She struck herself with her small fists, struck hard at her knees and thighs with a loud smacking sound, then pounded her chest, "Melanie!" and swung both fists at the same time, pounding her withered biceps and her shoulders, pummeling herself fiercely with unexpected strength and fury, trying to hurt herself. "Stop it, Melanie!" Laura was shocked and frightened by her daughter's sudden self-destructive frenzy. Melanie punched herself in the face. "I got her," Earl shouted. The girl bit him as he tried to restrain her. She freed one hand and clawed her own chest with sufficient ferocity to draw blood. "Jesus," Earl said as the girl kicked him with her bare feet and twisted loose again. Frowning at Marge, Dan said, "Programmed them to be promiscuous and masochistic? Is that sort of thing possible?" She nodded. "If the psychologist has a deep and broad knowledge of modern brainwashing techniques, and if he's unscrupulous, and if he has either a willing subject or one he can physically detain and control for lengthy periods, then it's possible. but it usually takes a long time, a lot of patience and perseverance. The astonishing and frightening thing in this case is that Hofritz seems to have been able to program these girls in a matter of weeks, after working with them only an hour or two a day, just 3 or 4 times a week. Apparently he developed some new and damned effective methods of psychological conditioning. But with the first 4, it wasn't long-lasting, never longer than a few weeks or months. Eventually, each girl's original personality resurfaced. First, she felt guilty about her sexual acrobatics with Hofritz, but continued to take perverse pleasure in the humiliation and pain of her masochistic role. Then, she gradually grew to fear and despise the whole sadomasochistic aspect of the relationship. Each of these kids said it was like waking from a dream when they finally began to want to be free of Hofritz. All 4 girls eventually found the will to break it off. "Good God," Dan said. "I believe there is a good one, but sometimes I wonder why he lets men like Hofritz walk the earth.
Why didn't these girls report him to the police? Or at least to university officials?"
"They were deeply ashamed. And until we found and questioned them, they never suspected that their masochistic aberrations were Hofritz's work. They all thought those twisted desires had been in them all along."
"But that's amazing. They knew they were involved in behavior modification experiments. So when they started behaving in ways they'd never behaved before..." She held up one hand, stopping him.
"Willie Hofritz probably implanted post-hypnotic directives that inhibited each girl from considering the possibility that he was responsible for her new behavior."
It scared Dan to think the brain was just so much silly putty that could be so easily manipulated.
Melanie scuttled past Earl and sprang to her feet and took 2 awkward steps into the middle of the bedroom, where she stopped and swayed and almost fell. She began once more to scourge herself, hammering herself as if she felt that she deserved to be punished, or as if she were trying to drive some dark spirit from her traitorous flesh. Stepping close, grunting as the small fists glanced off her, Laura threw her arms around her daughter, hugging her, trying to pin the child's arms at her sides. When her hands were restrained, Melanie still didn't settle down. She kicked and screamed. Earl Benton stepped in behind her, sandwiching her between him and Laura so she couldn't move at all. She could only shout and weep and strain to break free. The 3 of them remained like that for a minute or two, while Laura spoke continuously and reassuringly to the girl, and finally Melanie stopped struggling. She sagged between them.
"She done?" Earl asked.
"I think so," Laura said.
"Poor kid."
Melanie looked exhausted. Earl stepped back.
"Docile now?"
Melanie allowed Laura to lead her to the bed. She sat on the edge of it. She was still weeping.
Laura said, "Baby, are you all right?"
Eyes glazed. The girl said,
"It came open. It came open again. All the way open."
She shuddered in revulsion. "The 5th girl," Dan said. "The one he beat up and put in the hospital. What was her name?" The stocky psychologist moved away from the twilight-darkened window, returned to her desk and slumped in her chair, as if these unpleasant memories had drained her in a way that a hard day's work never could.
"Not sure I should tell you."
"I believe you have to.
Invasion of privacy and all that."
"Police investigation and all that."
"Doctor-patient privilege and all that," she said.
"Oh? This 5th girl was your patient?"
"I visited her several times in the hospital."
"Not good enough, Marge. Carefully worded, but not quite good enough. I visited my dad every day when he was in the hospital for a triple heart bypass operation. But I don't figure a daily visit gives me the right to call myself his doctor." Marge sighed.
"It's just that the poor girl suffered so much, and now to dredge it all up again 4 years after the fact, I'm not going to find her and dredge up the past in front of a new husband or her parents or anything like that," Dan assured her. "I may look big and dumb and crude, but actually I can be sensitive and discreet."
"You don't look dumb or crude."
Thank you. You do look dangerous. I cultivate that image. It helps in my line of work. She hesitated a moment longer, then shrugged. Her name was Regine Savannah. You're kidding. Would Ermatrude Galkenchettle kid about anyone's name? Sorry. He wrote Regine Savannah in his small notebook. You know where she lives? Well, at the time it all happened, Regine was a junior in the undergraduate program. She shared a large off-campus apartment in Westwood with three other girls, but I'm sure she's long gone from that address. What happened after she got out of the hospital? Did she drop out of school? No. She finished her studies, took her degree, although there were those who wished she would have transferred. Some felt it was a continuing embarrassment to have her here. That sentiment baffled him. Embarrassment? I think everyone would have been happy that she recovered sufficiently, physically and psychologically, to go on with her life. Except that she continued seeing Huffritz.
What?
Amazing, huh? She went on seeing him after he put her in the hospital? That's right. Worse, Regine wrote a letter to me, in my capacity as department head, defending Huffritz.
Good God.
She wrote letters to the university president and to a few other faculty members on the review board. She did everything in her power to keep Willie Huffritz from losing his job. A creepy feeling settled over Dan again. He was not by nature given to melodramatic action or thought. But somehow just talking about Huffritz was beginning to make his blood run cold. If Huffritz was able to acquire such control of Regine, what breakthroughs might he and Dylan McCaffrey have achieved once they had combined their demonic talents? For what purpose had they turned Melanie into a near vegetable? Dan could no longer sit still. He got up. But it was a small office, and he was a big man, and there wasn't much of anywhere to pace. He just stood there by his chair, hands in his pockets, and said, "You would think after he beat Regine, she would have been able to break his hold on her." Marge shook her head. After Willie Huffritz was booted off the faculty, Regine actually brought him to a number of campus functions as her escort. Dan gaped at her. Marge said, "And he was her only guest at graduation."
Good Lord.
Both of them enjoyed rubbing our faces in it. The girl needed psychiatric help. Yes. Deprogramming. A sadness had taken possession of the psychologist's kind face. She took off her glasses as if they were suddenly much heavier than they had been heretofore, an unbearable weight. She rubbed her weary eyes. Dan had a good idea how the woman felt. She was dedicated to her profession, and she was good at what she did, and she maintained high personal standards. She had scruples and ideals. With her well-developed conscience, she must believe that a man like Huffritz was a discredit not only to the profession, but to all of those who were his associates. She said, "We tried to see that Regine got the help she needed, but she refused it." Outside, sodium vapor lights had come on, but they couldn't hold back the night. Dan said, "Evidently, then, the reason Regine didn't turn against Huffritz was because she liked the beating he'd given her." "Evidently." He had programmed her to like it. "Evidently." He'd learned from those first four girls.
"Yes."
He'd lost control of them, but he'd learned from his mistakes. By the time he'd gotten to Regine, he'd learned how to keep an iron grip. Dan had a move, work off some energy. He took 5 steps to the bookshelves, returned to his chair, and put his hands on the back of it. "I'll never be able to hear the words behavior modification without getting sick to my stomach." Defensively, Marge said, "It's a justifiable area of research, a reputable branch of psychology. Behavior modification can help us find ways to teach children more easily and make them retain what they learn far longer than they do now. It can help us reduce the crime rate, heal the sick, and perhaps even create a more peaceful world." As Dan grew increasingly eager for action, Marge seemed, by contrast, to seek relief in lethargy. She slumped down even farther in her chair. She was a take-charge kind of person, the sturdy type who was confident of dealing with anything, but she couldn't deal with inexplicably monstrous men like Huffritz. and when she was confronted with something that she could not grasp and control, she looked less like a career whack and more like a grandmother in need of a rocking chair and a cup of tea and honey. Dan liked her even more because of that vulnerability. Her voice was tired. Behavior modification and brainwashing aren't the same thing at all. Brainwashing is a bastard offshoot of behavior modification, a twisted perversion of it, just as Hoffritz was not an ordinary man or an ordinary scientist, but a perversion of both. Is Regine still with him?
I don't know.
The last I saw of her was more than 2 years ago, and she was with him then. If she wouldn't drop him after the beating, then I suppose nothing he did would cause her to leave. So she's probably still been seeing him.
Unless he got tired of her, Marge said.
From what I've heard of him, he'd never get tired of someone he could dominate and terrify. Marge nodded grimly. Checking his watch, anxious to get away now, Dan said, "You told me Dylan McCaffrey was brilliant, a genius. Would you say the same of Hoffritz?"
"Probably. In fact, yes. But his genius was a darker variety, twisted, bent."
"So was McCaffrey's."
"Not half as twisted as Hoffritz," she said.
"But if they started working together with substantial, maybe even unlimited funding, with a human subject, with absolutely no legal or moral restrictions, they would be a dangerous combination, wouldn't they?"
"Yes,"
she said. A pause.
"Unholy."
The word unholy seemed like uncharacteristic hyperbole coming from Marge, but Dan was sure that she had chosen it carefully.
"Unholy,"
she repeated, leaving him without a doubt as to the depth of her concern. In the hall bathroom, with some iodine and a big patch band-aid, Laura was able to take care of the small wound on Earl Benton's hand, where Melanie had bitten him during their struggle. "It's nothing," he assured Laura. "Don't worry about it." Melanie was sitting on the edge of the bathtub, staring at the green-tiled wall. She couldn't have been more unlike the hellion who had lashed out at them in the bedroom a few minutes ago. A human bite is more likely to become infected than that from a dog or cat, or virtually any other animal, Laura said.
"You soaked it good with the iodine, and there's hardly any bleeding, just a shallow bite. Doesn't even hurt," he said, though she knew it must sting at least slightly.
"Had a tetanus shot lately?" Laura asked.
"Yeah, I was doing skip tracing work last month. One of the guys I tracked down took exception to being found, pulled a knife on me. He didn't do much damage. Took about 7 stitches to close it. That's when I had the tetanus booster. Real recent."
"I'm so sorry about this."
"You already said."
"Well, I am."
"Listen, I know the girl didn't mean it. Besides, it's part of the job."
Laura crouched in front of Melanie and examined the redness on the child's left cheek. It marked the spot where she had punched herself in the midst of her frenzy. It would develop into a bruise, given time. At the open neck of her blouse, scratches showed on her throat and chest where she had clawed herself. Her lip was still puffy and sore-looking, where she'd bitten it this afternoon at the end of their hypnotic therapy session. Dry-mouthed with fear and worry, Laura said to Earl,
"How can we possibly protect her? It's not just some faceless enemy out there that wants to get at her. It's not just government agents or Russian spies. She wants to hurt herself, too. How can we protect her from herself?"
"Somebody's got to stay with her.
Watch her every minute."
Laura put a hand under her daughter's chin, turned her head so their eyes met.
"This is too much, baby. Mommy can try to deal with the bad men out there who want to get their hands on you, and Mommy can try to deal with your condition, help you come out of this, but now, this is just too much. Why do you want to hurt yourself, baby? Why?"
Melanie stirred, as if she desperately wanted to answer, but as if someone were restraining her. Her stricken mouth twisted, worked but soundlessly. She shuddered, shook her head, groaned softly. Laura's heart literally ached as she watched her pale and slender daughter struggle unsuccessfully to cast off the shackles of autism. Chapter 20. Ned Rink, the ex-cop and former agent for the FBI, who had been found dead in his car in the hospital parking lot earlier in the day, owned a small, tidy, desert-style ranch house on the edge of Van Nuys. Dan drove there straight from his meeting with Marge Gilkenchettle. It was a low house with a flat roof that was covered with white stones, set in the middle of a particularly flat part of the San Fernando Valley, on a flat street of other low, flat houses. The shrubbery, with typical Southern California chlorophyllic exuberance, was the only thing that relieved the harsh geometry of the house and the monotonous tract around it, both of which clearly dated from the late 1950s. The house was dark. The streetlight in front of the place had a dirty globe and didn't illuminate much. Blank black windows and patches of pale yellow stucco walls could be glimpsed between the shadowy forms of neatly shaped plum-thorn bushes, 5-foot-high hibiscus, miniature orange trees, full-size date palms, and sections of a lantana hedge. Cars were parked along one side of the narrow street. Even though the unmarked police sedan was nestled in darkness, midway between two streetlights, under an immense overhanging laurel, Dan spotted it at once. One man sat in the nondescript Ford behind the wheel, slumped down, watching the Rink house, barely visible. Dan drove past the house, circled the block, returned, and parked half a block behind the department sedan. He got out of his car and walked to the Ford. The driver's window was half open. Dan peered inside. The plainclothes cop on the surveillance detail was an East Valley Division detective, and Dan knew him. His name was George Padrakis, and he looked like that singer from the 50s and 60s, Perry Como. Padrakis rolled the half-open window all the way down and said, "Are you here to relieve me, or what?" He sounded like Perry Como, too. His voice was soft, mellow, and sleepy. He consulted his wristwatch. "Nope, I still have a couple hours to go. It's too early to relieve me." "I'm just here to have a look inside," Dan said. Head twisted sideways to stare up at Dan, Padrakis said, "This your case, huh?" "It's my case. Wexlersch and Manuelo already tossed the place earlier." Wexlersch and Manuelo were Ross Mondale's right-hand men in the East Valley Division, two career-conscious detectives who had hitched their wagons to his train and were willing to do anything for him, including bend the law now and then. They were toadies, and Dan couldn't stand them. "They on this case, too?" Dan asked. "Didn't think you had it all to yourself, did you? Too big for that. 4 dead altogether, one of them a Hancock Park millionaire? Too big for the Lone Ranger approach." "What have they got you out here for?" Dan asked, squatting so he was face to face with Padrakis. "Beats me. I guess they figure there might be something in Rink's house that'll tell them who he was working for, and maybe whoever hired him will know it's in there and will come here to get rid of the evidence." "At which time you nab them." "Ridiculous, ain't it?" Padrakis said sleepily. "Whose idea was this?" "Whose do you think?" "Mondale," Dan said. "You win your choice of the stuffed animals." The chilly breeze suddenly became a chillier wind, rustling the leaves of the laurel overhead. "You must have been working around the clock if you were at that house in Studio City last night," Padrakis said. "Pretty nearly around the clock. So what are you doing here?" "Heard there was free popcorn." "You should be home, having a beer, your feet up. That's where I'd be." "I'm out of beer. Besides, I'm dedicated," Dan said. "They leave you with a key, George?" "You're a workaholic, from what I hear. You going to psychoanalyze me first, or can you tell me did they leave you with a key?" "Yeah, but I don't know I should let you have it." "It's my case." "But the place has already been tossed." "Not by me. Wexlersch and Manuelo. Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Come on, George. Why are you being such a pain in the ass?" Reluctantly, Padrakis fumbled in a coat pocket for the key to Ned Rink's house. "From what I hear, Mondale wants to talk to you real bad." Dan nodded. "That's because I'm a brilliant conversationalist. You should hear me discuss ballet." Padrakis found the key, but didn't hand it over right away. "He's been trying to track you down all day." "And he calls himself a detective?" Dan said, holding his hand out for the key. He's been looking for you all day, and then you waltz in here instead of going back to the station like you promised him. And I just give you the key. He won't be happy about that. Dan sighed. You think he'll be any happier if you refuse to give me the key and then I have to go smash a window to get in that house? You wouldn't. Pick a window. This is stupid. Any window. Finally, Pedrakus gave him the key. Dan went down the sidewalk, through the gate, to the front door, favoring his weak knee. They must be in for more rain. The knee knew. He unlocked the door and stepped inside. He was in a tiny foyer. The living room on his right was dark, except for the pale grayish glow that came through the windows from the distant street lamps. To his left, back through a narrow hall, a lamp was on in a bedroom or study. It hadn't been visible from the street. Wexler and Manuelo had apparently forgotten to switch it off when they'd finished, which was just like them. They were sloppy. He snapped on the hall light, stepped into the darkness on his right, found a lamp, and had a look at the living room first. It was startling. This was a modest house in a modest neighborhood, but it was furnished as though it served as a secret retreat for one of the Rockefellers. The centerpiece of the living room was a gorgeous 12-foot by 12-foot, 3-inch deep Chinese carpet, with a pattern of dragons and cherry blossoms. There were mid-19th-century French chairs with hand-carved legs and feet, a matching sofa upholstered in a lush off-white fabric that exactly matched the color of the unpatterned sections of the carpet. Two bronze lamps with intricately worked bases had shades of crystal beads. The large coffee table was unlike anything Dan had seen before. It seemed to be entirely bronze and pewter, with a superbly etched oriental scene on the top. The upper surface curved around to form the sides, and the sides curved under to form the legs, so that the entire piece seemed fashioned from a single flowing slab. On the walls, the landscape paintings, each ornately framed, looked like the work of a master. In the farthest corner, a period French étagère held a collection of crystal, figures, vases, bowls, and each piece was more beautiful than the one before it. The living room furnishings alone had cost more than the entire modest house. Clearly, Ned Rink had been making a good living as a hired murderer. And he knew just where to put his money. If he had bought a big house in the best neighborhood, the IRS might eventually have noticed and asked how he could afford it. But here, he could appear to be in modest circumstances while living in splendor. Dan tried to picture Rink in this room. The man had been squat and decidedly ugly. Rink's desire to surround himself with beautiful things was understandable. But sitting here, he would have looked like a roach on a birthday cake. Dan noticed there were no mirrors in the living room, remembered there had been none in the foyer, and suspected there would be none anywhere in the house except, of necessity, in the bathroom. He almost felt sorry for Rink, the lover of beauty who couldn't stand to look at himself. Fascinated, he went back down the hall to have a look at the rest of the place, heading first for the room where Wexler and Manuelo had left a light burning. As he stepped through the door, it suddenly occurred to him that maybe the light couldn't be blamed on Wexler and Manuelo, that maybe someone else was in the house right now. That maybe someone was there illegally, in spite of the fact that George Pedrakus was watching the front entrance, and at the same time, he glimpsed movement out of the corner of his eye as he went through the doorway, but it was too late. He turned and saw the butt of a pistol swinging at him. Because he turned into the blow, he took it square on the forehead instead of alongside his skull. He went down. Hard. The overhead light went out. He felt as if his skull had been half crushed, but he wasn't unconscious. Hearing movement, he realized his assailant was stepping past him toward the door. There was light in the hall, but Dan's vision was blurred, and all he could see was a shapeless form silhouetted by the glow. That silhouette seemed to be gliding up and down and going around in circles at the same time, like a figure on a carousel, and Dan knew his grip on consciousness was tenuous. Nevertheless, he heaved forward on the floor, gasping as the pain in his head lanced all the way down into his shoulders and back, and he grabbed tenaciously at the fleeing phantom.
He caught a fistful of material, a leg of the man's trousers, and jerked as hard as he could. The stranger staggered, collided with the doorframe, and said, "Shit!" Dan held on. Cursing, the intruder kicked him in the shoulder, then again. Dan had both hands on the guy's leg now, and was trying to pull him down on the floor where they would be more evenly matched. But the guy was holding on to the doorframe and trying to shake him loose. He felt as though he were a dog attacking a mailman. The intruder kicked him again, in the right arm this time, and his right hand went numb. He lost half his grip on the perp's leg. His vision blurred further, and the light seemed to dim. His eyes stung. He gritted his teeth as if to bite into consciousness and hold on to it with his jaws. The stranger, still a black shape against the vague hall light, bent toward him and clubbed him again with the butt of the gun. On the shoulder this time. Then in the middle of his back. Then in the shoulder again. Blinking, fighting to clear his burning eyes, Dan let go of the guy's leg, but whipped his good left hand up and tried to grab the bastard's throat or face. He got hold of an ear and tore at it. The stranger squealed. Dan's hand slipped off the blood-slick ear, but he hooked his fingers in the perp's shirt collar. The intruder hammered Dan's arm, trying to make him let go. Dan held fast. Some of the numbness seeped out of his right arm, and he was able to push himself up with that hand while he pulled himself up with the hand that was hooked in his adversary's shirt, onto his knees. Then one foot on the floor, thrusting up, shoving the guy backward, into the hall. They staggered two or three steps, turning as they moved, like a pair of clumsy dancers. They crashed to the floor, both of them this time. He was right on top of the guy now, but he still couldn't see what his adversary looked like. His vision wouldn't clear, and the hall light was still dimmer than it should have been. His eyes burned as if acid had gotten into them, and he figured it must be sweat and blood pouring down from the gash in his forehead. He reached inside his coat and pulled his .38 police special out of his shoulder holster. But he couldn't see the other guy swinging at his hand and couldn't duck the blow that came. Something hard whacked his knuckles, and the gun flew out of his grasp. Grappling, they rolled against the wall, and Dan tried to drive his good knee into the stranger's crotch, but the bastard blocked him. Worse, the guy either kicked or struck Dan's other knee, the bum knee, which was his weak spot. A reptile, quick flash of pain, slithered up his thigh and chased its tail around and around in his stomach. Being hit on that knee could sometimes be like taking a kick in the balls. It knocked all the wind out of him, and he almost let go. Almost. The guy clambered over him and tried to scramble away toward the kitchen, but Dan held on to the scumbag's jacket. The perp crawled, and Dan half-crawled and was half-dragged along behind him. It might have been funny if they hadn't both been hurting and breathing like well-run horses. And if they hadn't been deadly serious. Vision swimming and dimming, Dan launched himself forward in one last desperate effort, trying to lever himself on top of the intruder and pin him. But the perp apparently decided that the best defense was a good offense, so he stopped trying to get away and turned back on Dan, cursing so hard he sprayed spittle, pounding and flailing with what felt like four or five arms. They rolled back down the hall a few feet before finally coming to a stop with the intruder on top. Something cold and hard poked against Dan's teeth. He knew what it was. The barrel of a gun. "Stop this crap, now," the stranger said. With the muzzle vibrating against his teeth, Dan said, "If you were going to kill me, you'd have done it already." "Push your luck," the intruder said, and he sounded just angry enough to pull the trigger whether he wanted to or not. Blinking furiously, Dan cleared his vision slightly, not much, just enough so he could see the weapon, blurry, huge as a cannon jammed into his face. He saw the man beyond the piece, too, although not distinctly. The ceiling light in the hall was above and behind the son of a bitch, so his face was still pretty much in shadows. His left ear hung in an odd way, dripping blood. Dan realized that his own eyelashes were gummed with blood. Blood was still seeping into his eyes along with copious streams of salty sweat, which was half the reason he couldn't clear them. He stopped struggling. "Let go, you bulldog bastard," the intruder said, kneeling on top of him, heaving each word out with a new breath as if the words were lead ingots that had to be cast off with great effort. "Okay," Dan said, letting go of him. "You crazy man?" "All right," Dan said. "You have tore my fucking ear off." "All right, okay," Dan said. "Don't you know when you're supposed to stay down, you stupid son of a bitch?" "Now?" "Yeah, now. Okay. Stay down. All right." The intruder eased back, still pointing the gun at him, but no longer holding it against his teeth. He studied Dan warily for a moment, then stood up, shakily. Now Dan could see him better, but it didn't much matter because it was no one he remembered seeing before. The guy backed off toward the kitchen. He held the gun with one hand and his bleeding ear with the other. Defenseless,
Not daring to move lest he be shot, Dan lay on his back on the hall floor, head raised, blood trickling into his eyes, smelling blood, tasting blood, heart hammering, wanting to go for it, wanting to rush the bastard in spite of the gun, having to control himself, able to do nothing but just watch the guy escape. It made him mad as hell. The perp reached the kitchen. The back of the house was open, and he reversed through it, hesitated, then ran. Dan scrambled after his own piece, which was on the floor by the doorway of the room where he'd been ambushed. He snatched up the revolver, heaved, and stumbled to his feet, cried out as a grenade of pain went off in his bum knee, somehow shoved the pain down into a little box in his mind, and clamped a lid on it, and plunged toward the kitchen. By the time he reached the back door and stepped out into the cool night air, the intruder was gone. He had no way of knowing which side of the redwood fence the perp had jumped. Dan washed his face in Rink's bathroom. His forehead was bruised and abraded. His vision had drifted back into focus and had locked there, although his head felt as though it had been used as a blacksmith's forge. He knew he wasn't suffering from concussion. His head wasn't the only thing that ached. His neck, his shoulders, his back, and his left knee throbbed. In the medicine cabinet above the bathroom sink, he found a package of gauze, made a compress out of it, and set it aside. He discovered some Bactine, too, and he sprayed the scraped flesh of his forehead, blotted it gingerly, sprayed it again. He picked up the gauze compress and held it firmly against his forehead with his right hand, hoping to stop the bleeding altogether while he prowled around the house. He went to the room where he had been ambushed, and he switched on the light. It was a study, less elegantly but just as expensively furnished as the living room. One entire wall of bookshelves was built around a television and VCR. Half the shelves were used for books, the other half were filled with videotapes. He looked at the tapes first and saw some familiar motion picture titles, Silver Streak, Arthur, all the Abbott and Costello pictures, Tootsie, The Goodbye Girl, Groundhog Day, Foul Play, Mrs. Doubtfire, several Charlie Chaplin films, two Marx Brothers pictures. All the legit movies were comedies, and it figured a professional hitman might need to laugh a little when he came home from a hard day of blowing people's brains out. But most of the movies weren't legit. Most of them were pornographic, with titles like Debbie Does Dallas and The Sperminator. There must have been 200 to 300 porno titles. The books were of more interest because that was what the intruder apparently had been after. A cardboard carton stood on the floor in front of the bookcases. Several volumes had been plucked off the shelves and piled in the box. First, Dan examined the collection and saw that every one of the books was a non-fiction study of one branch of the occult or another. Then, still holding the gauze to his forehead with one hand, he pawed through the 7 volumes in the carton and saw they were all by the same author, Albert Uhlander. Uhlander? He reached into an inner jacket pocket and pulled out the small address book that he had taken from the Studio City house last night, from Dylan McCaffrey's wrecked office. He paged to the U listings and found only one. Uhlander. McCaffrey, who was interested in the occult, had known Uhlander. Rink, who was interested in the occult, had at least read Uhlander. Maybe he had known Uhlander, too. This was a link between McCaffrey and Ned Rink. But were they on the same side? Or were they enemies? And what did the occult have to do with this? His thoughts were spinning, and not merely because he had been clubbed in the forehead. Anyway, Uhlander was evidently a key to understanding what was going on. Apparently the intruder had broken in there only to remove those books from the house to conceal the Uhlander connection. Pressing the gauze to his forehead, Dan left the study. Like an electric current, the pain seemed to pass through the gauze into his hand, up his arm, into his right shoulder, down to the middle of his back, up to his left shoulder, into his neck, along the side of his face, completing the circuit by returning to his forehead, starting all over again. Favoring his left knee, sorting through things with one hand, feeling like a big, crippled bug, he searched the place perfunctorily and found nothing more of interest. Rink was a hitman. And hitmen didn't assist police investigations by keeping handy little address books and paper records of their affairs.
In the bathroom again, he removed the compress and saw that the superficial bleeding had, indeed, finally stopped. He looked like hell. But that was fitting, because he felt like hell, too. Chapter 21. When Dan limped out to the curb, carrying the small box of books, George Padrakis was still behind the wheel of the unmarked sedan, sitting in darkness, his window half open. He cranked it all the way down when he saw Dan. "I was just on the squawk box, Mondale once. Hey, what happened to your forehead?" Dan told him about the intruder. Padrakis opened the door and got out of the car. He looked and sounded like Perry Como, and he moved like him, too. Lazily, casually, with unconscious grace. He was even casual as he reached inside his coat and drew his revolver. "The guy's gone," Dan said, as Padrakis took a step toward Rink's house. "Long gone." "But how'd he get in there?" "Through the back." "This street's been quiet, and I had my window down," Padrakis protested. "I'd have heard breaking glass, anything like that." "I didn't find a broken window," Dan said. "I think he came in by the kitchen door, probably with a key." "Well, hell, then they can't blame it on me," Padrakis said, holstering his revolver. "I can't be two places at once. They want to watch the back of the house, too. They should have put two men on the place. You get a good look at the joker who jumped you?" "Not real good," Dan returned the key Padrakis had given him. "But if you see a guy with a badly mangled ear, that's him." "Ear? I nearly tore his ear off." "Why'd you do that?" "For one thing, because he was trying to bash my brains in," Dan said impatiently. "Besides, I'm sort of like a matador. I always try to take a trophy home with me, and this guy didn't have a tail." Padrakis looked baffled. A gigantic motorhome turned the corner, engine roaring, and lumbered down the block, like a dinosaur. Frowning at the box in Dan's hands, Padrakis raised his voice above the shrieking engine of the nature lover's vehicle. "What's that you've got there?"
"Books."
"Books?
Assembled sheets of paper with words on them, for the purpose of conveying information or providing entertainment. Now what about the squawk box? What's Mondale want?"
"You taking those books with you?"
"That's right."
"Don't know if you can do that."
"Don't worry, I can manage. They aren't that heavy."
"That's not what I mean.
What's Mondale want?"
Staring unhappily at the box in Dan's arms, Padrakis waited until the motorhome had passed, like a brontosaurus making its way through a primeval swamp. Its wake of cold air and exhaust fumes washed over them.
"I called in to let Mondale know you were here."
"How thoughtful of you, George." "He was about to head over to the sign of the pentagram on Ventura."
"Good for him."
"He really wants you to meet him there."
"What the hell's a sign of the pentagram? Sounds like a bar where werewolves hang out."
"I think it's a bookstore or something," Padrakis said, still frowning at the box of books. "A guy's been killed over there."
"What guy?"
"The owner, I think. Name's Scaldone. Mondale says it's like the bodies in Studio City."
"There goes dinner," Dan said.
He headed along the sidewalk, through alternating pools of purple-black shadows and wan amber light, toward his own car. Padrakis followed him.
"Hey, about those books. Do you read, George?"
"They're the property of the deceased.
Nothing like curling up with a good book, though they're not nearly so entertaining when you're deceased."
"And this isn't like a crime scene where we can just cart away anything that might be evidence." Dan balanced the box on the bumper of his car, unlocked the trunk, put the box inside, and said,
"The man who does not read good books has no advantage over the man who can't read them."
"Mark Twain said that, George." "Listen, until a member of his family has been located and gives approval, I really don't think you should..." Slamming the lid of the trunk, Dan said,
"There is more treasure in books than in all the pirates' loot on Treasure Island. Walt Disney."
"He was right, George. You should read more."
"But books are not merely lumps of lifeless paper, but minds alive on the shelves. Gilbert Hyatt."
He clapped George Padrakis on the shoulder.
"Expand your narrow existence, George. Bring color to this drab life as a detective. Read, George, read.
But... Dan got in the car, closed the door, and started the engine. Petrakis frowned at him through the window. Dan waved as he drove away. After he'd turned the corner and went a couple of blocks, he pulled the car to the curb. He got out Dylan McCaffrey's address book. Under the S listings, he found a Joseph Scaldone, followed by the word pentagram, a phone number, and an address on Ventura. Almost certainly the murders in Studio City, the death of Ned Rink, and now the Scaldone killing were linked. It was looking more and more as if someone out there was desperately trying to cover up a bizarre conspiracy by eliminating everybody involved in it. Sooner or later, they would either eliminate Melanie McCaffrey as well, or snatch her away from her mother. And if those faceless enemies got hold of the girl again, she would vanish forever. She wouldn't be fortunate enough to be saved a second time. At 7:05, Laura was in the kitchen preparing dinner for herself, Melanie, and Earl. A big pot of water was working up to a boil on the stove, and a smaller pot of spaghetti sauce and meatballs was also heating. The room was filled with mouth-watering fragrances, garlic, onions, tomatoes, basil, and cheese. Laura rinsed off some black olives and added them to a big bowl of salad. Melanie sat at the table, silent, unmoving, staring down at her hands, which were folded in her lap. Her eyes were closed. She might have been asleep. Or perhaps she was just withdrawn farther than usual into her secret, private world. That was the first meal Laura had made for her daughter in 6 years. And even Melanie's depressing condition could not entirely spoil the moment. Laura felt maternal and domestic. It had been a long time since she had experienced either of those feelings, and she had forgotten that being a mother could be as satisfying as anything that she accomplished in her profession. Earl Benton had prepared the table with plates, glasses, silverware, and napkins. Now he sat across the table from Melanie, in his shirt sleeves and shoulder holster, reading the newspaper. When he came across something surprising or shocking or funny in a gossip column, Dear Abby or Miss Manners, he would read it aloud to Laura. Pepper, the calico cat, was curled comfortably in the corner by the refrigerator, lulled by the humming and the vibrations of the motor. She knew that she wasn't allowed on kitchen counters or tables, and she usually kept a low profile while in the room to avoid being chased out altogether. Abruptly, however, the cat shrieked and popped onto her feet. Her back arched. Her fur bristled. She was wild-eyed, and she spat angrily. Putting down the newspaper, Earl said, "What's wrong, Puss?" Laura turned from the cutting board where she was making the salad. Pepper was alarmingly agitated. The calico's ears were flat against her skull, and her lips were drawn back in a snarl, fangs revealed. "Pepper, what's wrong with you?" The cat's eyes seemed to bulge in terror from its head and fixed for an instant on Laura. There was nothing of the domestic pet in those eyes, nothing but sheer wildness. "Pepper?" The calico bolted out of the corner, squealing in fear or rage or both. She dashed toward a row of cabinets, but suddenly wheeled away from them as though she'd seen something monstrous. She streaked toward the sink instead, then shrieked, and abruptly changed direction again, claws ticking and scraping on the tile. She chased her own tail for half a dozen revolutions, spitting and snapping her jaws, then leaped straight into the air as if she'd been stung or swatted. Slashing at the air with her claws, she pranced and twisted on her hind paws in a weird St. Vitus's dance, came down on all fours, and was moving even as her forepaws touched the tile. She flashed under the table as if running for her life, between the chairs, out the kitchen door, into the dining room. Gone. It had been an incredible display. Laura had never seen anything quite like it. Melanie had been unaffected by the cat's performance. She still sat with her hands in her lap, head bowed, eyes closed. Earl had dropped the newspaper and had risen from his chair. In another part of the house, Pepper let out one last miserable cry. Then, silence. The sign of the pentagram was a little shop in a bustling block that was the very essence of Southern California hopes and dreams. Photographs of this portion of Ventura Boulevard could have been used in a dictionary as the sole definition of bootstrap capitalism. One small store or restaurant shouldered up against another, block after block of enterprises owned and managed by entrepreneurs of all ages and ethnic backgrounds. And there was something for every interest and taste, both the exotic and the mundane. A Korean restaurant with maybe 15 tables, a feminist bookshop, a purveyor of handmade knives, something called the Gay Resource Center, a dry cleaner, and a party supply store, and a frame shop, and a couple of delis and an appliance store, a bookstore that sold only fantasy and science fiction, Ching Brothers Finance, loans to the reliable, a tiny restaurant offering Americanized Nigerian cuisine, and another specializing in Chinois, French-Chinese cooking. A merchant who sold military paraphernalia of all kinds, although not weapons. Some of these entrepreneurs were getting rich, and some never would. But all of them had dreams, and it seemed to Dan that in the early evening darkness, Ventura Boulevard was nearly as well lighted by hope as it was by street lamps. He parked almost a block from the sign of the pentagram, and walked past the eyewitness news van, similar vehicles from the news departments of KNBC and KTLA, marked and unmarked police cars, and a coroner's wagon. A crowd had gathered on the sidewalk, including curious locals, punk and gangster rap kids who wanted to look like street people but probably lived with their parents in $300,000 valley homes, and sensation-hungry media people with the quick-eyed look that always made them seem, to Dan, like jackals. He pushed through the crowd, saw the beat man from the Los Angeles Times, and tried to stay out of the range of the active minicam in front of which a reporter and his crew were filming a segment for the 11 o'clock news on Channel 4. Dan edged past a teenage girl with blue and green striped hair, twisted into punk spikes. She was wearing knee-high black boots, a minuscule red skirt, and a white sweater with a bizarre pattern of dead babies. The entire front of the shop was covered with amateurishly painted but colorful occult and astrological symbols, and a uniformed LAPD officer was standing directly under a faded red pentagram, guarding the entrance. Dan flashed his badge and went inside. The extent of the wreckage was familiar. The berserk giant who had smashed his way through that house in Studio City last night had come down his beanstalk again and had stomped through this shop as well. The electronic cash register looked as if someone had slammed a sledgehammer into it. Somehow, a current of life remained in its battered circuitry, and one red number flickered in its cracked digital readout window, an inconstant six, which seemed analogous to a dying victim's last word, as if the cash register were trying to tell the cops something about its killer. Some of the bookshelves were splintered, and all the volumes were on the floor in mangled heaps of rumpled dust jackets and bent covers and torn pages. But books hadn't been the only merchandise offered by the sign of the pentagram, and the floor was also littered with candles of all shapes and sizes and colors, tarot decks, broken Ouija boards, a couple of stuffed owls, totems, tikis, and hundreds of exotic powders and oils. The place smelled of attar of roses, strawberry incense, and death. Detectives Wexlersch and Manuelo were among the cops and SID technicians in the shop, and they spotted Dan as soon as he entered. They headed toward him, wading through the debris. Their icy smiles were identical, with no humor in either of them. They were a couple of land sharks, as cold-blooded and predatory as any real sharks in any sea. Wexlers was short with pale gray eyes and a waxy white face that seemed out of place in California even in winter. He said, "What happened to your head?" Walked into a low tree branch. Dan said, "Looks more like you were beating up some poor innocent suspect, violating his civil rights, and the poor innocent suspect was foolish enough to resist." "Is that how you handle suspects in the East Valley Division?"
"Or maybe it was a hooker who wouldn't come across with a free sample just 'cause you flashed your badge at her," Wexler said, grinning broadly.
"You shouldn't try to be amusing," Dan told him. "You have about as much wit as a toilet seat." Wexler's continued to smile, but his gray eyes were mean.
"Haldane, what kind of maniac you think we have on our hands here?"
Manuelo, in spite of his name, was not Hispanic in appearance, but tall and blonde and square-featured, with a Kirk Douglas dimple in the center of his chin. He said, "Yeah, Haldane, share with us the wisdom of your experience." And Wexler said, "Yeah, you're the lieutenant. We're just lowly detectives first grade." "Yes, please, we await your observations and your profound insights into this most heinous crime," Manuelo said mockingly. "We are breathless with anticipation." Although Dan was a superior officer, they could get away with this sort of petty insubordination because they were from the East Valley Division, not Central, where Dan usually worked, and most of all because they were Ross Mondale's pets and knew the captain would protect them. Dan said, "You know, you two made the wrong career decision. I'm sure you'd be much happier breaking the law than enforcing it."
"But really now, Lieutenant," said Wexlish, "you must have some theories by this time. What sort of maniac would go around beating people into piles of strawberry preserves?"
"For that matter," Manuel said, "what sort of maniac was this particular victim?"
"Joseph Scaldone," Dan said. "He ran this place, right?"
"What do you mean he was a maniac?"
"Well," Wexler said, "he sure to God wasn't your ordinary businessman."
"Don't think they'd have wanted him in the Chamber of Commerce," Manuelo said.
"Or the Better Business Bureau," Wexler said.
"A definite lunatic," Manuelo said. "What are you two babbling about?" Dan asked. Manuelo said, "Don't you think it'd take a lunatic to run a shop?" And reached into a coat pocket, withdrew a small bottle the same size and shape as those that Olives often came in. "A shop selling stuff like this?" At first the bottle did indeed appear to contain small olives. But then Dan realized they were eyeballs. Not human eyes, smaller than that, and strange. Some had yellow irises, some green, some orange, some red. But although they differed in color, they all had approximately the same shape. They were not round irises, as in human and most animal eyes, but oblong, elliptical, supremely wicked.
"Snake eyes," Manuelo said, showing him the label.
"And how about this?"
Wexler said, taking a bottle from his jacket pocket. This one was filled with a grayish powder. The neatly typed label read, "Bat guano."
"Bat shit,"
Wexler said.
"Powdered bat shit," Manuelo said.
"Snake eyes, tongues of salamanders, necklaces of garlic, vials of bull blood, magic charms, hexes, and all sorts of other weird crap. What kind of people come in here and buy this stuff, Lieutenant?"
"Witches,"
Wexler said before Dan could speak.
"People who think they're witches," Manuelo said.
"Warlocks,"
Wexler said.
"People who think they're warlocks."
"Weird people," Wexler said.
"Maniacs," Manuelo said. "But this place, it accepts Visa and MasterCard," said Wexler, "with, of course, acceptable ID."
Manuelo said, "Yeah, these days, warlocks and maniacs have MasterCard. Isn't that amazing?"
"They pay off their batshit and snake-eye bills in 12 easy monthly installments," Wexler said.
"Where's the victim?" Dan asked. Wexler jerked a thumb toward the rear of the shop.
"He's back there auditioning for a major role in a sequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre."
"Hope you guys at Central have strong stomachs," Manuelo said as Dan headed toward the back of the store.
"Don't barf in here," Wexler said.
"Yeah, no judge is going to allow evidence into court if some cop barfed on it," Manuelo said. Dan ignored them. If he felt like barfing, he'd be sure to do it on Wexler and Manuelo. He stepped over a heap of mangled books that were saturated with spilled jasmine oil, and he moved toward the assistant medical examiner, who was crouched over a shapeless, crimson thing that was the last of Joseph Scaldone. Working on the theory that the calico cat might have detected a stealthy sound too soft to be detected by human hearing, and might have been frightened by the presence of an intruder in another part of the house, Earl Benton went from room to room, checking windows and doors. He searched in closets and behind the larger pieces of furniture. But the house was secure. He found Pepper in the living room, no longer frightened, but wary,
The cat was lying on top of the television. She allowed herself to be petted, and she began to purr.
"What got into you, puss?"
he asked. After being petted a while, she stretched one leg over the side of the TV and pointed at the controls with one paw. She gave him a look that seemed to inquire if he would be so kind as to switch on the heater with pictures and